all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Jim Fossum.
And welcome to Veterans Radio, broadcasting from Studio A and WAAM Talk Radio in Ann Arbor. And with me today is Bob Gould.
Hey, hello, Bob. Out there, yeah. And you are the host out today. I'm just out here kind of, I'm your wingman.
That's great. Glad to have you aboard. We've got a fantastic program. It's going to be quite inspiring. But as always, listeners, when we tell you, when you tune into Veterans Radio, have a pen handy, a piece of paper. We've got a couple of announcements to make for you. These are some programs for veterans and veterans' friends that you may want to attend. We had the Michigan Veterans Affairs Agency on a couple of weeks ago. They told us about some upcoming expos they have, and they have one in Grand Rapids on September 5th and 6th. You can get information on that by calling 517-324-8330. 8330. They're going to be talking jobs, education, healthcare. Real good program. The state is moving that around. They already had the one in the UP in Marquette. They're now in Grand Rapids, and they'll do one in Detroit in November, and we'll tell you about that. But the one in Grand Rapids is September 5th and 6th, and you can reach them at 517-324-8330.
You know, I do want to add something, and I'm sure, Jim, that you can back this, that if all our listeners out there, if they have an event that they can let us know, go to veteransradio.net, our website, veteransradio.net, and click on Talk to Us, About Us, whatever, and let us know about your event. We'd like to put that on. What else do you have, Jim?
Well, we've got another one in early September here, really the biggest one in Southeast Michigan, September 10th, the Veterans Summit with the Canton Community Foundation.
Oh, that's going to be so cool.
My firm, Legal Help for Veterans, helps organize that. It's always got 300 or 400 people in it. You can get to canfoundation.org. It's held at Laurel Manor in Livonia, Michigan. The phone number is 734-495-1200, and you'll hear a little bit more about that later. We've got one that I like to promote for my friend Gunny Norm Wilcox, the Southeast Michigan Veterans Stand Down on October 8th. You can call Gunny at 248-808-0929. You can't find a better man who dedicates himself to helping out underserved veterans. And, Bob, we've actually got somebody who contacted us about jobs for veterans locally that I wanted to pass along. An Army veteran contacted us and said her employer is looking for a handful of veterans.
Who so might that be?
We're always interested in helping that out.
Absolutely.
Laird Glass and Upholstery in Plymouth, Michigan, looking for glazers and auto glass installers, and they're willing to put you into a training program and get you apprenticeship up into this new field.
You know, and we do here at Veterans Radio. We hear I can't find any. Well, you know why you can't? Because you're not looking hard enough or listening to Veterans Radio, or going to our website. We do have on our website jobs for vets, so you can go on our website, you can look at the listings and the postings that we have, and if you're a business, you can let us know. Once again, go to our website.
So Laird Glass and Upholstery in Plymouth, Michigan is looking for glazers and auto glass installers. You can call that Army veteran, Bridget, at 734-740-8867. And talk to them about the job requirements and whether or not it might be something you'd be interested in. But we'd be thrilled if we were helping to continue to hook up veterans with available job openings, because there are a lot of them out there. You just have to have somebody tell you about them.
So. That's right. Amen.
Well, we have an interesting new sponsor.
We do. We do. We have the American House Living Senior Living Community. And American House, they are in Michigan, folks. So those of you in Nebraska, well, you know, go get a cup of coffee real quick. But this is the American House Senior Living Community. And, man, first of all, the founder and creator of American House, Mr. Bob Gillette, is a Vietnam vet. Doesn't get any better than that. That means he knows how to take care of the troops. Now, this is not only for veterans. This is for civilians, too. But there is special attention being given to the veteran community at American House. And they've been in business for over 30 years. They have a color guard. They have photographs of veterans. They have veterans events that are planned. And what do you have?
Bob Gillette and this is a family-owned business for 30 years, as you mentioned, Bob, and they do a wonderful job with the veterans. The Brigadier General Carol Ann Fossone and I are good friends with the Gillettes. We've helped them on a number of things. They've helped us when they have. We're trying to place a veteran into a good living situation. So we couldn't be more proud to have them on the Veterans Radio team. And we'll have a discussion with our upcoming guest, Justin and Dahlia Constantine, right after this message from American House.
Living at American House is like being on a cruise ship with all the lovely surroundings, the many, many activities, and the people to share with. It's so comfortable to be here. I feel safe. I don't have to shop. I don't have to cook. I don't have to clean up.
When you move into an American House senior living community, you open the door to a new world of possibilities. Our life enrichment directors are committed to enhancing the lives of residents every day. We look forward to finding out what interests you.
I just get dressed up and walk down to the dining room and enjoy my meals in the company of other people at my table.
For more moments made in American House, go to AmericanHouse.com. Again, that's AmericanHouse.com. Or watch us at YouTube.com/AmericanHouseLiving.
Living here has enriched my life. I'm Carol Huck, and I'm made in American House.
Welcome back to Veterans Radio. We're glad to have you listening in to what I think is going to be a great conversation for the rest of the hour with Justin and Dahlia Constantine. Justin, why don't you say hello to the Veteran Radio listening audience?
Well, hi there. I hope you can hear me okay.
We hear you.
We're really excited. Okay, great. We're excited to be on the show today. Thanks so much for inviting us.
We hear you great. And I'm even more excited to tell you the truth to talk to your spouse as a military spouse myself. Dahlia, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you. We're excited today.
Do you get to do joint appearances very often, or are we finally going to get your voice out there?
I think we did one once a few years ago, but we were just laughing at it. We haven't done this in a really long time, so I'm really looking forward to that.
Well, let's see if we can have you each learn something about the other through this process. So that'd be wonderful. So let me set it up a little bit for our listeners. Justin is a Marine, retired Lieutenant Colonel, just recently retired, and joined the reserves in 2005. You'd previously been on active duty from 1999 to 2004, but volunteered to deploy to Iraq. At that point, you and Dahlia were not married, and you were setting about your duties in the Marine Corps with what should have been just sort of a normal day on October 18th, 2006 in the El Anbar province of Iraq, but it was anything but a normal day, as it turned out, wasn't it, Justin?
Well, that's right. I was significantly injured that day, but I will say leading up to that day, it was a tough time for us with the Marine Corps in El Anbar. We lost a lot of Marines in a short time period there, and every day we were in some sort of combat situation with the insurgents there.
Let me ask you before we get into that day, though, what motivated you to want to join into the Marine Corps and serve the country?
Oh, gosh, going back to that would take me back a ways. A friend of my father's a Vietnam vet. He was a Marine who served in Vietnam, and he talked to me a lot about the benefits of joining the Marine Corps, and he gave me one of Senator Webb's books, Fields of Fire, which I read, and that was fantastic. I thought the Marine Corps was something I wanted to do. And I applied for an ROTC scholarship for college, did not get that, and then couldn't go to officer candidate school because I was working two jobs over summer to pay for college. So it wasn't until I was in law school I found out it was still an opportunity to do that. And I thought the Marine Corps would be a really good fit for me. I wanted to serve the country. For me, the military was a way to do it. There are hundreds of other ways as well. I really appreciate the challenges and the respect the Marine Corps gets across our country. So I thought it would be a good fit for me, and it was.
I think it's always interesting to find out what motivated someone to serve their country, because it sometimes is a small spark started many years before that the date of entry into service, and it sounds like it was that for you. It was something you thought about and just never really let go of because it was something you knew at your core you had to do.
That's exactly right. I mean, I probably talked to my father's friend, Mr. Parker, a lot going back to I graduated high school in 1988, and so it was, you know, 87, 88 when we were talking. I didn't join the Marine Corps until 10 years later.
And during that 10-year period, you worked your way through college and then into law school?
That's right. And it was just a random. I didn't think there was a chance to join the Marine Corps later. I was working at the school gym at law school, and one of my friends came by and I said, where are you going? He said, I'm going to go down and talk to the recruiter. I said, what are you talking about? He said, yeah, they have a program where if you're on a legal track, you can join the Marine Corps. I said, well, tell them I'll be down there tomorrow. And I went down there and got into the program for that summer.
So tell us really a little bit about what your assignments were when you went on active duty for the next, I guess, 4 or 5 years.
Sure. Well, my first duty assignment was, well, like all officers, I went to Officer Cadet School in Quantico, then the basic school for 6 months to learn how to be a platoon commander, and then Naval Justice School for 10 weeks up at Newport, at Naval Justice School. And then my first duty station was Okinawa, Japan, and I was a defense counsel for the Marines who got in trouble there. And so I was very busy that year in Okinawa, had a lot of cases. And then at the end of that year, because I was single under the company, of course, so it was just a one-year tour. From there, I went to Camp Pendleton, California, and worked for almost 4 years more on the prosecution side. And again, had a lot of cases, and then worked with general staff on helping them with the prosecution side. So I saw both sides of the fence during my active duty time in the Marine Corps.
And tell us how you found yourself in Iraq.
I got, as you said in the introduction, I left active duty in 2004 and started working for the Department of Homeland Security as an attorney. I joined the reserve in 2005. It was really specifically for attorneys teaching deploying units the laws of war and the Geneva Conventions and stuff they would need to know once they got in the theater. And then another local reserve unit, the 4th Civil Affairs Group out of Anacostia, Washington, D.C., sent out a message. They were looking for officers who would deploy with them, and I hadn't deployed while in active duty and felt pretty bad about that, so I quickly volunteered to be a civil affairs team leader for the deployment. I was lucky enough to lead a small team of 8 Marines, David Corman. Most of my NCOs had already deployed to Iraq once, so that was a huge help for me. And once we got in theater, we pushed out to Havania and fell in with 3rd Battalion, 2nd Marines, which is out of Camp Lejeune, North Carolina.
And before we get too far into what your general duties were at that point, Dahlia, you had just recently met Justin. I think it's 5, 6, 7 months before he deployed to Iraq, as I understand it.
That's right. We had met in Argentina. A few months before he deployed.
And when this guy said to you, hey, I'm going to deploy to Iraq, what was your thought process?
He had already left. We met in Argentina in a Spanish language class, and he had already left back to the States. When he was in Argentina, he said, you know, there's a chance they might call me up for deployment. I don't think it's going to happen. And then somehow mysteriously, a few days after arriving, it was certain that he was deploying to Iraq. So I think he was just holding it in as a secret until he got back on safe soil in the U.S. But my dad at that time was a cultural affairs advisor in Iraq with the U.S. Army. So I had a little bit of experience with someone being over there, but I just knew it would be really different with Justin as a Marine there. And it was really nervous. I didn't really know much about war, what it was like. So it was a hard time. Not as hard as afterwards, but it was a hard time for sure.
Yeah, I think that initial news to every spouse and family member gets broken sort of softly by the active duty troops not wanting you to begin worrying too soon, but just sort of fill it in the pit of your belly, don't you?
Absolutely. And my first thought was, how are you going to tell your parents? Because as hard as it is, I think, to tell me, I'm sure it was a million times harder to tell his mom and dad.
And when you got to Iraq, Justin, what sort of activities would consume your typical 7 days a week?
Sure, it was very busy, as you said, no days off, of course, for anyone there. As a civil affairs team leader, my job was to develop contracts with the local Iraqis to help rebuild infrastructure that had been destroyed, stuff like cleaning up water treatment plants and making the roads more drivable and schools, electricity, stuff like that. But the insurgency, as I mentioned, was very powerful at the time. They would visit the local Iraqis at night with very real death threats just for the slightest sign of cooperating with us, at least where we were. So it was very difficult to convince them to work with us. And so my impressions were that, you know, most Iraqis were caught between a rock and a hard place. They wanted to work. They needed the money, certainly. They wanted to get their town back in order. The only way to really do that was to work with us. And as I said, they, to do so, though, would place their own lives in great risk. And so that was a challenge we faced. I was the battalion commander, Colonel DeGrossier, maybe part of his staff, and also his jump team, what he called his jump team, which is about a dozen of us who went out regularly. And so I would either go out with his jump team to check on his Marines and make sure they were doing okay, or go have a meeting with a government official, or more offensive-related operations. And then I would send 2 or 3 days with my team as well, helping train them. And they had their duties as well, so they would check with them to make sure that everything was going okay. But we would go out across the wire together on our civil affairs missions. And so basically it was getting up early, going out on some sort of mission, and having our meetings in sync with our battle rhythm, and then sending our intel reports later at night, and just starting again the next day.
And you arrived, I think, roughly the late summer of 2005, and the injury we're going to talk about, it happened in October of 2006. So by then you had been crossing the wire 5 times a week and probably feeling like you were sort of a pro at assessing what was going on.
Well, actually, you had one little detail wrong there. You said we got there in the late summer of 2005. We got there in late summer of 2006.
Ah, okay.
So I was actually only there for 6 weeks. But, yes, we did go out across the wire a lot, but so much was going on. As an example, about two weeks before I was shot, we were on another patrol. Of course, a lot of the Marine Corps patrols are dismounted, and we had about a squad, and a lieutenant and I saw a bump in the road, and we were trying to figure out what it was. We got closer, and turns out it was an IED, and we were pretty close to it. We both saw and heard it go off at the same time. We dove, and we were sprayed with dirt and rocks, and if they had put it in correctly, it would have been shrapnel that sprayed us, and certainly from that distance, it would have killed us. So very fortunate that day, and a week before that was our first, week or two before that was our first night convoy, or my team's first night convoy, and we're part of a bigger convoy. We're one truck out of four, and we're the third truck, and I was in the front with the night vision goggles, and I saw the first vehicle get blown up by an IED. And so, again, those are two very significant actions leading up to when I was injured that was my experience, but also typical of what was going on with the rest of the Marines and soldiers in that area. So we all were exposed to a lot of enemy fire one way or the other, but going out and into the contested territory and taking it over was part of the mission.
And this was in the area between Fallujah and Ramadi, Justin, is that where?
That's exactly right. We were pushing towards Ramadi, pushing westward. That was the goal.
And I suppose that brings us then to October 18th. Well, let me back up and ask one question. During those that first month or so as you're having these experiences, what sort of information are you filtering back to the family or Dahlia? What sort of information is he filtering back to you?
He kept a lot from me. I didn't know about the IED incident until well after we had gotten out of the hospital, and one of his friends mentioned it, and I was like, what are you talking about? It But I think I knew things were serious when I was in England at the time, and Justin would send me, you know, cards or letters. And then one time he sent me this envelope, and I opened it, and all that was in it was a target practice, like a paper, a target practice, and showing that he had gotten his target. And I thought, wow, okay, well, this is serious. This isn't, you know, this isn't just me talking to him anymore. But he kept, I knew he was scared, and I knew about some of the concerns he had, but most of what he told me were his concerns for his younger guys. He rarely shared concerns about himself, and we didn't really hear a lot about that until he was home and safe.
And were you keeping it also away from your family, Justin, your immediate family?
Oh, yeah, certainly. I didn't share with my parents, you know, the harsh realities of what was going on over there. I mean, my parents, of course, are proud of me, but they also wondered what is up with my career, why I volunteered to deploy. I didn't have to do that. I hadn't deployed in active duty. I think they understood as a Marine, you know, I felt really awkward not having deployed, but, you know, they're telling me to, you know, be as honest with them as really what it's like on the ground there. Unnecessarily, and what Don is talking about is when we had just gotten our scopes for our rifles, so we were VGOing our weapons, and, you know, with the scopes, it's easy to get all their shots at a tight group on target, so I kind of joke, I sat on the target saying, looks like I'll be good to go over here, but ironically, I wasn't, but,
Well, one of the things
no reason,
I think
there's no reason to share too much with the family, but Dawn and I were able to communicate almost every day with email, so I did keep her up to date with what was going on, try to communicate with her when I got back from patrols and stuff, which is one way she knew something had gone wrong, because she didn't hear, she could probably elaborate more on this, but she didn't hear back from me one day after she knew we had gone on patrol, which was October 18th.
Well, there's so much communication now, and I'm sure your parents have related that even though you weren't telling them a lot, they were hearing a lot about what was happening to the Marines in Fallujah and the push to Ramadi. And again, these are hard things for the family left behind and for the spouses, the parents, the brothers and sisters. And certainly that's, going through your mind over there as well.
Yeah, I think it's going to be harder for the people at home, because you only get bits and pieces, compared to, you know, I had generally a good idea of what the threats were, what was going on, and I knew how comfortable or uncomfortable I felt. Couldn't really explain that to them. It wasn't tactically wise to explain that to them, and all that. So I do think it's tough on the families who are just waiting and waiting, yet to hear the news report sometimes just can be disastrous.
So on October 18th, 2006, you stepped out of your up-armored Humvee. I understand you were warning a journalist about an enemy sniper who had been killing Marines in the area. The unthinkable happened. Tell us what you remember.
Yeah, that's exactly right. We had it was about our third stop that day. I don't remember most of it. The reporter has told me what happened, as did the corpsman who saved my life and others around me. And I remember early on in the morning stopping by one of our forward operating bases and stopping by an Iraqi police station that had been shot up the night before so the colonel could talk to the police chief. I guess I noticed the reporter was just kind of standing around, which is a bad idea when there could be a sniper in the area. And he and I were in the same vehicle. And as you mentioned, we got to our stop, which is another one of the forward operating bases, or near a forward operating base, and we were walking away from the Humvee, and I said to them, hey, Jay, you got to move quicker here. Don't forget about that sniper. We don't want you to get hurt. And he told me that based on that, he took a big step forward. And a split second later, a bullet came in right where his head had been and hit the wall between us. But before I could really react, the next round came and hit me behind my left ear and exploded out of my mouth, causing incredible damage. And the Marine style was dead because of all the blood and because it was a headshot. In fact, when Coleman Grant rolled me over, I was no longer breathing.
And that 1 inch of exposed skin between the Kevlar vest and the Kevlar helmet, it was all it took. I want to mention Navy Corpsman George Grant is the one who immediately came to your side and performed an emergency tracheotomy, if I understand it correctly.
Yeah, you're right on all counts there. It was amazing that the bullet was able to, the shot, whether it was lucky or skillful or both, just said, you know, very little amount of room between that tele helmet and the neck guard. And then Coleman Grant, he's a real hero here. He was a young kid at the time. He had never performed a tracheotomy on a human before. He had done it once in a training environment on a pig. The snipe was still shooting. This is a battlefield. It was in a clean environment. George was wearing 65 pounds of protective armor, like we all were, and it was probably 100 degrees that day. So, of course, he was sweating like crazy, and I was bleeding like crazy. He did such a good job on my tracheotomy. The plastic surgeon at Bethesda thought another surgeon had done it. All of these incredible, challenging circumstances, and George put his life on the line to save me and executed perfectly.
And this, folks, is really one of those stories where there are multiple heroes throughout it. Certainly what Justin's gone through, and Dahlia, we're going to talk more after the news here shortly on the next part of this story. But without Navy corpsmen like George Grant and Lance Corporal Bueller, who we haven't talked about, but he's the one who then drove you, apparently reaching speeds over 70 miles an hour down a road that you know there are IEDs at and snipers are shooting at, to get you to an aid station so that you'd have a chance at actually pulling through this thing. So, boy, there's two heroes. We'll be right back in about 2 minutes after the news.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans' Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
And welcome back to Veterans Radio. We have Lieutenant Colonel Justin Constantine and his wife Dahlia with us. I'm Jim Fossone with Veterans Radio. And we're certainly glad to have you here and ask that you like us on Facebook so that you can continue to be notified of upcoming programs. And just before the news break, we heard about the shot that changed your life dramatically, Justin, that came out under the left ear and out through your mouth. I think there was probably a series of hospital stops and rehab facilities, but before we get to that, I guess I want to hear from Dahlia, because you said that you guys were talking by email just about every day, and one of the things you knew was wrong was when you didn't hear from him.
Sure. So the night before, Justin and I were on Google chat, essentially, like an instant messenger, and he said, I'm going on patrol tomorrow, and as soon as I'll get back, I will email you or call you. And I had just moved to England maybe 3 weeks before that, so my phone wasn't still working, and I was a little nervous about him calling. I went to, I had a conference that morning outside of Cambridge, England, but I woke up expecting that he would have sent me an email or a call. I checked both, and there was nothing from him. And you get that feeling in the pit of your stomach, like something's wrong. And then, of course, your rational mind tries to say, you know, Dahlia, he's in a war zone. He might not be able to get to a phone. Maybe something's wrong with the computers. Just calm down. Things are fine. And I kind of convinced myself that it was just, you know, phones were down or the internet was down. In the taxi ride on the way out of Cambridge, I noticed a cemetery, and it gave me an eerie feeling. And normally I'm not really scared of cemeteries. They don't terrify me or anything like that, but something about it made me really nervous. And I asked the taxi driver about it. I said, what is the cemetery? And he said, that's the American cemetery from World War II. And for whatever reason, when he said that, I just had this awful feeling in my body that something had gone wrong and that things weren't right. I went to the conference and I came back and I thought, well, definitely he contacted me by then. There was still no phone call, still no email, still nothing. So I said, okay, I'm going to take a nap right before dinner. When I woke up, I looked at my email really quickly and I thought there was an email from Justin. In actuality, it was from Justin's mom, whose name is Judith Constantine. So just at first glance, I saw the J-U and the Constantine. And the subject line said, Justin is okay, Dahlia. It was a short email, but she was letting me know that they had heard he was injured and that he was okay. He had survived. And, of course, at the time, they didn't have much information either. They were just getting bits and pieces as well. And I literally just sat in front of my computer for hours crying, and I didn't know what to do. That's just that initial shock of it. But it was just one of those days, and I think I've talked to so many family members who had very similar experiences where they just had an awful feeling in the pit of their stomachs on that day, knowing that something had gone wrong.
And Delia, why don't you tell our audience why you were in Cambridge, England at the time?
I just started a doctoral program I started at the beginning of October. So Justin and I had met in Argentina. I was from California and he was from Virginia. So we had dated over that summer, and then he deployed to Iraq, and then I went to England for my doctoral program. So we were all over the map for a while.
And as you're sitting there with that sort of pit in your stomach, what was your inner strength or focus at that point? Was something telling you what you had to do next?
You know, I think the best way I can describe it is that it wasn't so much a decision as a really easy non-decision. It was just adrenaline, just moving forward. You know, I think I always have that feeling in my heart or my mind that things will work out, and it's just a matter of how am I going to get them to work out. So initially, I mean, I think it took me a few months to process what had actually happened, because I just immediately went to the hospital, and in the hospital I was in caregiver mode. It wasn't until we had gotten home a few months later that all the emotions suddenly came out, and, you know, I was suddenly processing it all. But I think at that beginning, you're just in survival mode, and that's what kicks in.
And when you're in that survival mode, did you have prior medical training or experience or in healthcare that sort of said, this is something I can do?
No, and my sisters joke around that I get really nauseous around blood. I was very squeamish before, and they said this is how they knew it was true love, because they couldn't picture me in a hospital environment whatsoever.
Nothing like your sisters to keep you grounded, right?
Exactly. I mean, I'm an elementary school teacher. And, like, if I had to help a kid with a Band-Aid, I used to turn around and gag because I used to get so upset by it. So, and then all of a sudden, here I was in the hospital with Justin. So it's just, you know, life pushes you and you rise up to it.
And how many days after the shooting did you see him in the hospital?
So I saw Justin actually 2 days after he was shot. Because I was in England, they transported Justin to a hospital in Iraq, in Balad, and then took him to Landstuhl, Germany, and there's a huge military base there. And that's kind of where they clean them up and stabilize them enough to bring them back to the United States. So I remember as soon as I found out he was in Germany, and because we weren't married, nobody tells you anything. You don't really have any rights yet. Because it's so HIPAA and everything else. But I just knew. I was like, I'm going there. So I remember calling the hospital and telling them, and I think I lied. I think I told them I was his fiance because I thought somehow that would help get me more information. And I said, well, I'm going to come there, so how can I do this? And then they kind of explained it to me. And as soon as I got off the phone, I booked my ticket, and I was off. I took the bus into Heathrow Airport, and then I was on a plane to Germany.
Were you talking with anybody? Were you talking with his parents, with your parents, your sisters, about what you were about to, you know, jump off the cliff into?
I think everyone tried to dissuade me, kind of. They were like, well, you know, he's just going to the hospital, and we don't really know what's going on. Wait till he gets to the United States. I'm going. And my mom, because I was back to being a student again, and here I was in another country, and I talked to my mom, and I said, well, I'm going. And then she said, all right, well, I just put the money in your account as we were talking so that you can just get over there and do what you have to do. What's interesting is that a couple of months before Justin was injured, my dad was in the hospital. He had some treatments for cancer and some surgery, and my mom was there every day in the hospital with him at UCLA, and I think she understood that I just had to be there. So she was really supportive of it from the beginning. You know, I think everyone thought I was a maniac, but it was just a matter of I'm going there. I have to be there. I mean, part of it is probably a lot of caregivers were control freaks, and we need to be there to monitor everything. So that's part of it.
Well, believe me, it's a necessary trait for the military spouse or loved one to have to help their warrior through it all. And I was going to ask you about the challenges of arriving and not being married and trying to get into the ward and into the room. How did you talk yourself into that?
Actually, at Landstuhl, they were pretty remarkable. As soon as that, you know, I had talked to them and said, well, I'm coming, here's my flight information, and just let him know I'll be there tomorrow. And there was actually a representative waiting for me at Frankfurt Airport, and he was, you know, Marine Corps a liaison with the hospital. And, you know, I kind of explained who I was. And it's very unusual for someone to go to Landstuhl because they're only there for a couple of days before they bring them back to the States. So most people, it's a lot harder to get over from the U.S. than it is from England. But they waited for me there, you know, it was a couple of hours out, and then I stayed at Fisher House at the hospital, which at that time was way bigger than my dorm room back in England, so I didn't know what was happening, really. And they were really supportive in Landstuhl and really encouraging and, you know, made sure I had dinner, took care of me. So that really helped completely, because here I was thinking I was going to have to lie and make up stuff to just get in the hospital room.
You really felt the Marine Corps brought you into the family at that point, I suspect.
Yes, that was my first experience, and they were just so thoughtful. You know, the Marine Corps liaison, his wife came and met me. Justin had a friend, his brother had a friend who was there. They came and took me out to dinner that night, and everyone was just really thoughtful and really supportive. And that made a huge difference, because I was still in that mode where I didn't really know what I was doing. I was just one foot in front of the other. I really needed that.
Dahlia, could you talk about what you, Fisher House, maybe we have some listeners who don't understand what the Fisher House does around the world, really, for our military spouses?
So what Fisher House does is Fisher House really believes in the power of families and the power of families to support their loved ones in the military. And what it is, I guess the best way I can describe it is similar to a small hotel that's close by to the hospital so that you could stay there and have a place to stay. But it's so much more than that. There's food there. There are people to talk to there, to comfort you. There are people to support you with resources there. And it's all free, because I think they know that when family members are injured, there isn't always the opportunity to have that extra money sitting around for hotel and meals and all the other costs that come along with it. So I remember there were women there cooking in the morning and people cooking in the afternoon and in the evening. And it's run on so many volunteers, but just a really amazing experience with Fisher House that I had from that moment.
And I'm wondering, when you first walked in and saw Justin, been able to see some of the photographs, and I should have mentioned this at the outset, I intended to, for the listening audience, this story, these heroic folks were brought to my attention by an AmVets article the magazine arrives at our house every month, and they were on the cover, and I began reading the story and said, I've just got to hear more of their story. But I'm wondering, having seen some of the early photographs of Justin and what tremendous damage the sniper bullet did, what was your reaction?
So when we were in Landstuhl, I got there, and of course I was just so eager to see him. I mean, partly because he had been injured, but partly because, you know, we were had just fallen in love, and I hadn't seen him in a couple of months, and I just really wanted to see him. And the doctor, this is a very serious German doctor, sat me down for an entire hour, and gave me a huge speech about how Justin looked different and how I wouldn't recognize him and how he had just come out of surgery and was under a lot of anesthesia and he may not recognize me. And then he made this joke and he said, he does not look like Brad Pitt, ha ha. And I was just like, okay, and I kind of wanted to push him aside and say, okay, just let me in there. So when I walked in the room, you know, they had said he's sedated, he's just out of a surgery, he's not going to recognize you. And then all of a sudden I walked in, and he tried to kind of move his body up to get out of bed, and it took like three nurses to kind of push him back down. And at that point, every single inch of him was bandaged up except for his hands and one eye, his one eye that hadn't sustained damage. And honestly, I looked into that one eye, and it was Justin. You know, the rest of him was kind of like a mummy, but really in that one, just looking to that one eye, I knew it was him, and that somehow that just made me know everything was going to be okay, even though it was just this tiny part of him.
Well, we'll come back and pick this story up. Apparently with that one eye look, he did look a little bit like Brad Pitt. We'll come back right after this from a message from one of our sponsors.
Schoolcraft College is proud to have served the communities of Southeast Michigan for five decades. So it should come as no surprise that they're just as committed to serving those who have served our country. Schoolcraft College Veteran Services provides assistance to veterans using their educational benefits. They help with the VA benefits application process, provide academic advising, and plan programs of study according to VA guidelines. Classes are forming now in Livonia and Garden City. Visit schoolcraft.edu for more information.
And we're back on Veterans Radio. Justin, obviously you went through a long recovery period, and I want to spend a little time on that, but I really want to talk about what's going on now. But, Dahlia, maybe you can help us transition from moving from Landstuhl to Walter Reed and begin that setup of the rehab work that had to come.
Sure. We were in Landstuhl just for a couple of days, and originally they had thought I could go on the plane with Justin back to the States. And then at the very last second, and I mean 5 minutes before the plane left, they told me I couldn't because they had to take another service member, which, you know, of course I couldn't argue with that. So I had to go back to England, pack up my stuff, let my professors know I wasn't coming back that semester. And then I headed back to to Bethesda with Justin. So once we got there, it was a rude awakening. I think I didn't know anyone. Luckily, Justin's best friend, his parents lived 3 miles from the hospital in Maryland, and they had a room for me, and they welcomed me as if they were my own parents, really. And again, it was just that support network, and I think that runs throughout our story, is that we were very supportive of each other, but we always had the support network of strangers, of friends, of family members who were there with us. And, you know, we had these funny stories. At the beginning, Justin, the only way he could communicate was by tracing letters on my hand. So you can imagine, just to get one word out, you know, just to say hello, to trace each letter individually on my palm. And apparently I was the only one who could understand his secret language. So he would try to do that with other people, and they had no idea what he was saying. Luckily, my work with elementary school kids helped me with these non-traditional forms of communication. So I was his interpreter, as we like to remark.
I'm not sure if that says more about you, Dahlia, or Justin at that point.
We developed this, you know, where he would kind of swipe my hand to indicate a space between words. So we had our code, and then he moved on to being able to write notes. But one of my earliest memories of Justin in Bethesda is that, I mean, here he was maybe a week or two out of his injury, and what we decided to do was to make a list of things we wanted to do when he got out of the hospital. Everything from going to the Marine Corps ball, to going to Hawaii, to going on a hike somewhere locally, but that was it from day one. It was constantly forward thinking, like, what are we going to do next? How are we going to achieve this? I really think that was a big part of the recovery for both of us, was just constantly moving forward and thinking ahead and knowing that we had this future ahead of us.
And Justin, what's as this process moves from days to weeks to months, how's that progressing in your mind?
Well, Jim, at the beginning, I didn't know how seriously I was injured. Dahlia and my mom was per the doctor's instructions, we put the cards we received in the mail up on top and covered the windows and mirrors so I wouldn't really see the extent of my damage, because they were afraid that would potentially put me in a lot of depression, because, you know, it was really, I almost didn't look human, the extent of the damage. I was also having some allergic reactions to medicine and some other conditions. I was hallucinating really, really badly at first, to the point where my heart would beat so fast I would start sweating, and they told Dahlia and my parents if I couldn't get my heart to slow down, I would have a heart attack and die. I was having terrible hallucinations of being deprived of oxygen or being in situations where I couldn't breathe because of the damage to my throat. In real life, it was bleeding over into my subconscious. Finally, they figured out what the problem was and were able to take care of that. So even the first few weeks there, it was touch and go. But once I realized the extent of the damage, I had survivor's guilt. Like all wounded warriors, I felt terrible about being in the hospital. I was really embarrassed about what happened. I just wanted to be back in Iraq with my Marines. I didn't want any of my friends to come visit me. I was just really embarrassed. But we were only in the hospital for about 5 weeks, which is pretty amazing. We went home to our house, which isn't too far away, so then I was really an outpatient. I would I would recover at home and come back in regularly for surgeries. But it was the best thing that happened because out of the hospital, I could sleep a lot at night. Otherwise, we were up every 4 hours having our my vital signs checked and stuff like that. And just the hospital is a busy place. Once I was home, though, I could get a good night's sleep. And I was not feeding tube for months. But, you know, this is a great example of what the difference between having a loved one around you and not. So I was there every day next to me in the hospital. A lot of other wounded warriors don't have that because their family lives halfway across the country. And back then, we didn't have the policies in place where everything was paid for, or someone could go on non-medical attendant orders to be there and get to have health care and be paid. And so I had the fortune of having Dahlia there every day. And when we left the hospital, the doctors and nurses had shown her how to clean my mouth and how to help me out so that I could leave. And, you know, life went on, and I was in a wheelchair first and then crutches. And then I just had surgeries along the way. I probably had a couple dozen now. Reconstructive surgeries. In fact, this October, it'll be 8 years later. And next week, I have another surgery on some scar vision inside my mouth. I still have a handful of surgeries to go, but that just goes to show what we learned, that a lot of us are surviving injuries that would have killed us in previous generations, but it takes a long time to recover from them. And that's whether you're an amputee or a traumatic brain injury, post-traumatic stress, or other physical wounds like mine. And again, I can't stress enough how lucky I've been to have Dahlia and my family being so close to me to make sure I've had a successful transition.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the messages I want to certainly get out to our listening audience beyond the importance of the military spouse role here, is that broader support network. And not everybody has the close family support that they can get, but that doesn't mean they don't need the support from other veterans, from veteran service organizations, the VA and other caregivers, and faith, the faith-based organizations as well. I think you've probably been touched by all of those through this struggle over the last 8 years.
That's exactly right, Jim. We had a number of veteran service organizations that helped me individually and helped both of us together. There, a lot of them are very present in hospitals, or at least were then. And you're right. A lot of us don't have family members who can be there, or we just aren't there for one reason or another. And so there are a lot of ways for people across this country to help, whether it's making financial donations to a good group, whether it's gathering their church together to help out in some capacity, whether it's to be one of those groups that brings someone in Christmas or Thanksgiving or something like that to their house. And so there's a lot of different ways for people to help out. I know a lot of people do care. We all certainly need it one way or the other.
And it was just about a year ago, I believe, Justin, that you medically retired from the Marine Corps?
Yeah, that's right. It was actually September. Time flies. It was September of last year. I had been promoted to Lieutenant Colonel in January and then was medically retired in September. And because it's a medical retirement, I retired at that rank, even though I hadn't served in that capacity for 3 years.
And I think it'd be important for our audience to understand some of the things that you're doing now and working on, and maybe how you're applying some of those lessons learned to life.
Well, I appreciate that, Jim. Yeah, I've been. It sounds funny to say, but and I guess every cloud has a silver lining. But the injury I went through has opened up a lot of doors that just wouldn't have happened in my life otherwise. Certainly, Dahlia and I have grown incredibly close throughout this process, but also there have been, for instance, I'm using VA's Voc Rehab Program, which is a great program, I mean, underutilized by a lot of our today's veterans, to get an advanced law degree in Georgetown, because I could no longer be a trial attorney like I had expected to in my career, and they helped me get an advanced law degree, which I can use later if I want to teach or work in a think tank. And that's a great government program. But I've also met some incredible people that work for halftime. I work with U.S. Chamber of Commerce's Hiring Our Heroes initiative, which is solely focusing on veteran hiring programs in the private sector for our transitioning service members, our military spouses, and our veterans. And I lead a small team. We focus on wounded warriors and caregivers. But I also have my own business, which I never would have started before. I'm an inspirational speaker now. I completely left being a lawyer after 15 years. Most recently, I worked for the FBI on a counterterrorism team, which was a great job. But I want to, you know, a lot of wounded warriors, well, I certainly feel this way, that there's only so much in life we can control. And I want to control as much as I can now because I've seen how it can all go away in an instant. And so I have my own business as an inspirational speaker, and I talk to corporations about lessons I've learned during my recovery that I think apply to anyone who's facing a challenge in their lives, and most people are. In fact, for instance, just 2 weeks ago, I was down in Dallas, and I spoke to the craft store Michaels at their annual leadership conference. I spoke to 1,700 of their managers about lessons I've learned during my recovery. And you wouldn't believe the outpouring of support from those people there about what they took from my speech, they applied to their life. Whatever challenges they are going through, they realize they can make it through, and they're stronger than they think they are. They can overcome the adversity. Just hearing about what Dolly and I went through, and so I can't tell you how proud that makes me when I hear other people taking inspiration from what we've gone through and applying it to their lives.
And Justin, how do people keep in contact with you? Why don't you give us your website?
Sure. Thanks, Joe. The easiest way, as you said, is my website, which is simply justinconstantine.com. Of course, I'm on LinkedIn and Facebook as well. And I would just like to share right now for any veterans out there listening or wounded warriors or anyone who has questions about veteran employment or really if they're HR managers, they have questions. I'm a luxury resource. If someone wants to come talk to the group, of course, that works as well. I do remember mention, I didn't mention it, my father grew up in Dearborn, Michigan. So I
oh, great.
Back to you.
That's excellent. I've got to get this in because I just got a text from my dear wife, the Brigadier General, that I didn't ask what happened, Dahlia. When did you guys get married?
We got married in 2008, and we actually got married at the Marine Corps Museum. We were, ironically, the first Marine Corps wedding. I think there was an Air Force wedding before us. So we were there, and it was a beautiful ceremony.
Well, it is both your love story, your recovery story, your story of hope for those who have been suffered catastrophic losses is really something that I think everybody listening to Veterans Radio today, those who listen to it on the archives, will take a lot out of it. It was really wonderful to have you both on as guests. I wanted to make sure I gave Dahlia plenty of time to get her views across because he gets, you know, he's the big shot. He gets hired to do this, right? And I'm going to end with you. Dahlia, tell us what you're going to do next.
So right now I'm teaching, and we're actually in a year or two going to move so that I could actually get back onto my doctoral road. And like Justin said, every cloud has a silver lining. It actually worked out perfectly. I realized I was way too young to do my doctorate, and I've had a chance to teach in our community, and I love it, and I feel much more prepared for the road ahead.
So we're
going strong, and it's all a team effort.
That's great. That'll help close the circle. I want to say thank you to both of you today. I want to thank our Veteran Radio sponsors, American House Senior Living, Legal Help for Veterans, Applebee's Restaurants, the Canton Community Foundation, Schoolcraft College, and Lynn Pitlack, CPA, and our friends at Rally Point. Please patronize these folks, and you are dismissed.